is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
U.S. and global markets were mostly range-bound from Monday through Thursday this week until taking a big hit on Friday after China announced retaliatory tariffs on the U.S., which was then followed by a response from President Trump, writing that American companies are hereby ordered to immediately start looking for an alternative to China. Between the retaliation news from China and Trump's barrage of angry tweets, the Dow fell over 600 points, or 2.4% on Friday. The S&P 500 fell 2.6%, and the Nasdaq even more at around 3% as U.S.-China relations continue to worsen. The two sectors of the market that got hit the worst were energy and technology, while traditional safe havens, gold, the Japanese yen, and U.S. Treasuries moved higher. Gold is now up nearly 7% this month, with the December gold contract settling at $1,537, a six-year high. Speaking at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, this week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell repeated his pledge to help the economy while acknowledging that the global economic outlook has been deteriorating. Given the trade spat this week and other factors, traders are now pricing in 100% odds of another rate cut when the Fed meets next month in September.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
So what we have been noting is a more cautious outlook in equities, and that's been based on the fact that we've seen a number of things that we've tracked very closely that have been highlighting to us that there's stress in the markets, and that means that more caution is warranted in risk assets. So for instance, some of the things that we look at are cross-asset volatility. So we started to see volatility arise across many different assets. We saw it rise in equities, but we also saw it spike hugely higher in fixed income volatility, and also we've seen some rise in FX volatility as well.
Last year, interest rates were rising and the stock markets fell. Do you find yourself reacting to market news, selling when you should be buying, and buying when you should be selling? Are you making costly investment mistakes? It's time to take control and develop a plan that keeps your investments centered, no matter what direction the markets take. We can help you protect your investments during market downturns and profit when markets rise. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management to create an investment strategy today. Call 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
August has turned out to be a pretty volatile month for the stock market. To give us an update on where things stand today is Erin Swenland. She's a senior technical analyst at StarCharts.com. And Erin, let's start off with the S&P 500. On the day that you and I are speaking, Thursday, August 22nd, we're trading in the 2900 region, which is only about 2% higher than the market peak back in early 2018. That was over a year and a half ago. So if you look at a chart, the overall trend still appears to be up, but it's been, I would say, a hard-fought battle for the U.S. stock market to make new highs just these last couple of years. That's nothing like what we saw from 2016 to 2018, where we were seeing new highs nearly every day. So what's your assessment of how the stock market has been behaving, let's say, over that time frame?
Well, I agree with you. You know, 2016 to 2018 was certainly a great run. I know that we quit even writing about the fact we were making a new all-time high just because every single day. And then things got a little bit rocky at the beginning of 2018 with that very difficult decline we saw. And, you know, since then, it has been rather rocky. Every time it seems like we get up there and get a new high, we're falling right back down. And so it has been extraordinarily volatile. And I wish I could say that it won't be going forward, but I think we're still going to be in for some rocky roads. It's going to be one of those things where you've got to have your stops tight, where you just have to be paying pretty close attention. You know, you can watch the Market Watchers live show on Stock Charts TV every morning, and we'll give you a little bit of a an idea of what we're thinking. But, you know, at this point, I think intermediate term, we still are going to probably see some new all-time highs before the end of the year. And right now, it's, I think, mainly watching to see which sectors are starting to lead and which ones are failing. And that, I think, gives us a better idea, because I know at this point, you know, consumer staples, utilities, REITs, you know, all of those have been doing quite well. But, you know, the idea is, of course, that everybody's always going to need toothpaste and right. beer, I guess, since that's a staple in there. you know, in utilities, that seems to be where all the interest is lying right now. And that is a bit of a concern when rallies are coming off these defensive sectors. I think that's really the clue or the hint that we need to pay closer attention. You know, we need to be watching what's going to happen here.
And when you say that, that's a fairly logical response, given the fact that yields continue to trend lower and lower. So if people are looking for a place to get a decent return, I mean, it's the defensive sectors, the consumer staples and areas like that, where they have to go into.
Absolutely. I mean, look at a Procter & Gamble. That usually has been mostly a sideways trading sort of vehicle in that staples area. And now it's one of the best performers in there. And it's been making, you know, new highs. It's, you know, it's rising pretty consistently now. I know there were a couple, Kimberly-Clark, I think, was another one in that area. And, you know, normally they aren't really the sexiest area to, you know, invest in. But when things are troubled, you know, gold, we've seen that huge resurgence in gold and bonds, both which are considered, you know, areas of a safe haven per se. So I think when we start seeing a little less participation in those defensive sectors, you know, I think at that point we can get a little more comfortable.
Let's talk about some of the charts that you have in your recent piece. You posted it yesterday, August 21st. One of the things that you point out is that the Dow weekly chart is showing a bearish rising wedge and that it's trying to execute with a breakdown. Explain what that means for us.
Okay, sure. You know, if you look at that chart, a rising wedge, you would draw, you know, your rising bottoms on that weekly chart. You would then connect the tops and it forms this sort of wedge-like look. And that's a pretty common chart pattern, and it's a bearish chart pattern. So it really is telling us to look for the Dow to start moving lower if we drop below that rising bottoms trend line. Now, it doesn't mean we will, but the fact that we're seeing that particular chart pattern is a little bit of a concern to me. And the problem is on that weekly chart for the Dow, we just got that negative crossover. So we got that sell signal last Friday. So when I look at the charts on a weekly basis, it is, you know, it's suggesting more downside. But when I start looking at my indicator charts, it's just telling me a different story right now. And I feel like I have to pay attention. You know, if you go to that article, you can see our indicators that I talk about. And it is a free article on stockcharts.com. You just go to the articles section and look up decision point and you'll find it right there. But our short-term indicators are rising strongly, really strongly. They're not overbought yet. It's telling me that we should expect some upside in the shorter term. And interestingly enough, the intermediate term indicators have started to turn up higher. And, you know, you see that near a market bottom, and that certainly gives me some optimism as far as getting up there and reaching those all-time highs. So, you know, you have to go by what the charts are telling you, not necessarily how you feel about the charts, how you feel about the market. I find that gets me into a lot of trouble. So that my feel for the market is still really shaky. And I'm concerned we're not, you know, getting over that short-term resistance. But then I look at these indicator charts and they're telling me it's going to be okay. So I have to pay attention to that. And yeah, so far we're starting to see the right movement on both those short-term and intermediate-term indicators.
What areas or sectors of the market are you currently seeing the greatest strength and
well,
weakness?
I think, as I said, we do have a sector scoreboard. And if you look at which ones are on neutral or sell signals in the market right now, it happens to be guess what? It's those aggressive areas that are showing the weakness. They're the ones that have lost their buy signals in the intermediate term. They're still mostly hanging out above their 50 is still well above their 200. So we're not going to be seeing long-term trend model sell signals. But intermediate term, these are the ones that are having problems. Energy, which has been having a problem for a really long time. So not a surprise to see those sell signals. But the other areas are financials, industrials, consumer discretionary. All of those went on neutral signals, and healthcare, which I found very interesting because that's a lot of times considered a less aggressive, more defensive sector. But when I've studied it, what I found is that healthcare is not really a defensive sector so much anymore, mainly because of all those biotechs that are in there. And they're just driving that sector all over the place. So I think that's part of the reason we're seeing that neutral in there. But the ones that are the strongest, when I look on my charts, real estate is super strong. Utilities still showing a lot of good stuff. Consumer staples, it's on a buy signal. So as long as those defensive sectors are what lead the market higher, like I said, I think that is generally what you see in a bear market situation. So I don't like that. However, we're starting to see some strength now building in technology and consumer discretionary. I mean, if you look on the sector summary that we have on stock charts, you can easily just go through it and see which sectors have been leading over the last week, over the last month. And when I look at what's leading over the last month, the top four, real estate, utilities, consumer staples, and healthcare. Those four have been the leaders for the past month in the market, all defensive sectors. However, I'm starting to see technology make a move. So when I look at just what's happened in the last week, the two that are leading are discretionary and technology. So we're starting to see some growth now coming out of those aggressive sectors. And that's what we want to see. That's what's going to take us to the new all-time highs. So I am feeling a little bit more comfortable seeing my indicators and starting to see some of that strength in those more aggressive sectors.
How does the U.S. stock market compare to other markets around the globe?
Right. So I have a chart in that article. It's called Global Markets. And basically, I have the S&P 500 on the top. And then underneath is the German DAX, the TSX in Canada. I use EWU for the UK, the French market, the Nikkei, India, Shanghai. I put all of those on one chart. And what I noted and what is really the main concern, I think, globally, is that when you look at what the all-time highs were in these markets, many of them were in 2018. And they're still in declining trends. For example, the German DAX, you know, at the beginning of 2018, hit its all-time high, pretty much with our markets at the end of that really great period we were talking about of pretty much going up almost every day.
Right.
And since then, it's formed a declining tops trend line, and it's yet to break from that. It's still below that from that point. Meanwhile, when you look at our markets, we've been making higher highs. So to see the German DAX starting to fail, UK is still struggling, which isn't a big surprise with the whole Brexit fiasco. Japan, though, it hit its high in October of 2018, and it's formed a declining tops trend line. And it's well away from that all-time high. Mm. All of these that you look at on here, Shanghai, all of them are really not near all-time highs that they set back in 2018. And I would say the one that really has managed to outperform and to do pretty much as well as the U.S. markets would be the TSX in Canada, because they still have been flirting with new all-time highs this year.
So out of those eight different markets that you're looking at across the globe, S&P is the clear winner, it looks like, with Canada in second. And then all the other major markets are basically trending behind. Maybe the French CAC index, it's been sort of in a long-term trading range, But it looks like, I mean, just to sum things up, it looks like the S&P or the U.S. stock market has been the strongest.
Absolutely. And it's really, you can see it visually on this particular chart. It's very clear, all those declining trends. And then I've marked, like I said, the all-time highs so that you can get a feel for how far away some of these markets are from their all-time highs.
Let's drill down into some asset classes. And I know that you cover what you refer to as the big four. So let's cover those areas, starting with the dollar.
All right. Well, the dollar has been in a rising trend now since the beginning of 2019, and it's continuing in that direction. As far as a monthly chart, though, if you were to look at that for the U.S. dollar itself, this area has been an area of overhead resistance at about 100 for the U.S. dollar. And we're getting up there. I think we're going to test that again. And the PMO is on a buy signal on the monthly chart. Everything's looking pretty good for the dollar right now. And, you know, that does sort of bring you into gold, right? If the dollar is doing well, typically gold will, travel in the opposite direction. Gold is denominated in dollars. So if the dollar rises, typically gold, the correlation is that gold is going to fall. But as we've seen of late, gold has really taken it out on its own. And if you look at a 20-day average of the correlation between gold and the dollar, it's sitting right now at zero, meaning they're completely not correlated. If whatever gold does, whatever the dollar does, it's really not going to affect it so much. Gold is taking a pause at this point, but I'm expecting it to go higher. It's in a symmetrical triangle, sort of a configuration. That's a continuation pattern, meaning we should be looking for an upside breakout. And I think getting back up to that 1550 level is completely possible. But I think it has some work to do. It needs to have this pause, work out those overbought conditions on the indicators. And I think that's what we're going to see for a little while longer on gold. But ultimately, I'm expecting it to break out once again.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting about the correlation between the dollar and gold. If you look at over the long term, there's definitely an inverse correlation between those two. But as you noted, it looks like we could see the dollar trend higher along with gold, which would be a positive correlation if both those asset classes are being seen as a safe haven, which is basically kind of what we've seen, wouldn't you say, with both gold and the dollar participating as people park their money into cash, into dollars, and into gold at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, and that usually, when you start to see gold break out, that usually means something bad is likely happening in the market. One of the interesting things to look at, I cover sentiment for gold. And what we do is we look at the Sprott Physical Gold Trust and calculate the premium and discount on it. And when you have high discounts, that means people are bearish gold. Sentiment being contrarian, you expect the opposite to happen. And, you know, we've seen a pullback in those discounts, but we still have discounts. So there's no reason to think that we won't continue higher when you look at that as far as the sentiment goes. So I'm encouraged by the fact that we still are reading discounts on that physical gold trust. I think that's really interesting. And it also tells me to expect some good things. But right now, you know, the momentum is shifting on gold to the downside. Our PMO is about ready to give us a sell signal. But like I said, I'm not expecting a huge decline here. I would be looking for more, blowing off that move, you know, just consolidating sideways. Like I said, taking a breather. That will bring, even if price travels sideways, that will bring the momentum down and get it out of overbought. And I think it would set us up nicely like it did at the end of July when we had the same thing happen.
Okay. Let's move on to crude oil. This is the third of the four big four that you cover. What's your assessment of the energy markets, particularly crude at this point?
Well, it's still in a declining trend. That's the one thing that bothers me. It hasn't been able to break out from that declining tops trend line. If you look at a USO daily chart, I think you could look at it and maybe make a case for sort of a complex reverse head and shoulders lining up here, which would be a bullish pattern, and you'd expect an upside breakout. But, you know, even if we get that breakout from that declining tops trend line, I'm still not sold on energy being a good place to move money or to be involved in. I would look for USO to probably top out at that July top that we saw. I think that's probably going to be its stopping point. I think that area of resistance is just going to be too strong. But in order to even get there, price has to get above its 200-day EMA. And, you know, that's managed to be pretty strong resistance as well for gold since June.
Yeah, the U.S. is basically trying to flood the world with oil. We're continuing to produce more and more. And if there's a lot of supply out there, that's going to keep prices suppressed. And on the other side, on the demand side, global growth has decreased from what we saw in the lead up to 2018, where we saw a pretty big synchronized upturn. Now we're on the downside of that. So I guess all in all, what you're saying is oil still looking like not the best place to put your money. And as you point out in your sector scoreboard, oil is still the weakest when you look at your intermediate and your long-term signals.
Yeah, absolutely. Energy is still just not the place to be. I mean, I wouldn't be even trying to round out my portfolio by including it. I don't have it right now. So I don't think that's the area that you should be concentrating on. But just for interest's sake, yeah, I don't see much coming out of it, at least in a way that we could make some money off of this.
Okay. And let's talk about the fourth area that you cover, and that's bonds. You look at TLT, which is iShares 20 plus year treasury bond ETF, as a proxy for the bond market. What's your assessment of the bond space?
Yeah, it's been pretty crazy, hasn't it? Almost a mania this month of people getting in. I mean, pretty much a vertical move that we've seen coming out of that, which was, you know, I was expecting a breakout. I expected to see some interest there, but not the kind of interest that we've seen right now. And it's extraordinarily overbought right now. But like gold, I don't see it just completely losing, support. I just don't see it making that move that far down. I would expect, just like with gold, we're going to see that really powerful move worked out with some consolidation, maybe a bit of a pullback, but wow, the interest in bonds, pretty spectacular. You have to look at that chart and wow.
Yeah, it definitely made a big move when you look at TLT. And a lot of that has to go with, again, like we were discussing, with yields heading lower and lower, especially when we think about what's happening internationally in Europe and Japan with negative interest rates. So those yields are just dragging down. They're kind of a gravitational pull on the yields in our market as well, pushing up bond prices. And so that's what we see with TLT and some of these bond markets.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think the interest is still going to be there. I just think that right now it's so overbought. Everybody's sort of waiting it out. Is it going to pull back and then I can get in? Like I said, it's just got to work its way through this pause, just like gold does. I think that ultimately they're going to break out to the upside, but they just need some time to work out of those overbought conditions.
Well, Aaron, as we wrap up, would you mind telling our listeners a little bit more about what you do at StockCharts.com, some of the different services that you provide, educational services, and then you're also telling me off the air that you're going to be starting up Decision Point again as well. So if you wouldn't mind, tell our listeners about some of these new things that you're doing.
Absolutely. So yeah, I still am a senior technical analyst over at StockCharts.com, so you will be able to read some commentary over there. From myself and my father, Carl Swinland. They offer, of course, plenty of learning center tools. Their charting tools are just the best. And then, of course, there's Stock Charts TV. I don't know if any of your listeners have checked it out. It's free. You just go to the website and click on it. We have tons of older shows on the Stock Charts TV YouTube channel. I'll be continuing to do Market Watchers Live in the mornings on there. It's just great fun. But yeah, we're reopening that decisionpoint.com website. My dad and I will be taking our commentary over to the site. I'll also be offering like a trader's corner bulletin where I'll be giving out stock ideas from our scans that we do based on our trading models. And another thing out there on the side is something called Wealthwise Women that I'm putting together with my partner, Mary Ellen McGonigal. And we're in the process of working with simplertrading.com. We'll be putting that together. It's going to be for absolute beginners. Great way to get those who aren't in the market interested. So certainly if any of your listeners have those beginners that maybe have been interested but a little too afraid to get involved, keep an eye on Wealthwise Women.
All right. Well, I definitely want to encourage all of you out there to go to stockcharts.com, check out Stockcharts TV, and also make sure to hop on over to Decision Point when that is reopened as well. Aaron, it was a pleasure speaking with you on our show again. We look forward to having you on in the future.
We'd love to come back.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
During almost all previous recessions, fiscal policy was actually tightening, meaning our deficit surplus as a percent of nominal GDP was rising. But lately, because of the tax cuts, because of the last budget deal, the deficit is actually rising. So from a fiscal monetary perspective, we're actually in an environment where the federal government is almost behaving as though we are in a recession. In fact, I think just recently the Congressional Budget Office came out and called this, you know, something along the lines of absurd that we're seeing such large increases in our deficit.
Joining us on the show today is Kathy Fetke. She's the CEO and co-founder of Real Wealth Network. And Kathy, last time we had you on the show, we were talking about how mortgage rates continue to move lower. And boy, that has really picked up, especially this month in August. I'm looking at a chart here of 30-year fixed rate mortgages, the average here in the U.S. And we were as high as just under 5% late last year. And now it looks like the average 30-year rate is just above 3.5. So we're at multi-year lows. If this trend continues, we're going to be back towards multi-decade lows. So is this having an impact on the housing market?
It will, most likely. It's kind of too soon to tell, but we did have higher sales just this last month. But that was kind of before rates hit their low. But you know, any time that rates go down, that's usually a stimulus. People are able to afford more. They're able to, you know, prices have gone up in housing and it's priced out a lot of people. So with lower rates, they might be able to come back into the market. And it's kind of a unique situation because over the past year, rates did the opposite. A year ago, they were pretty high. It really brought, I mean, high, relatively speaking. They were low, historically speaking, but high compared to the last 10 years. Real estate sales really slowed over the last year. And so price gains slowed down. And now we have lower interest rates. So the combination means that it's going to be a little bit more affordable for people. And this is really a wonderful window to get in if you've been trying to buy a home or buy an investment property. It's going to be a little bit more affordable right now.
Okay. Now, would you say that given your outlook on the housing market, it sounds like you're saying right now is a good time. Do you think that there's going to be more weakness ahead for housing, that people should be waiting for prices to come down? Or are you saying, no, this is basically it?
You know, there's a lot of people who are waiting for that shoe to drop, right? They maybe missed out on 2009 and 2010 when you could buy a foreclosure anywhere. You could buy properties for 10 cents on the dollar. It was, I hate to look at it through this filter, but it's just kind of what we do as investors is it was an incredible buying opportunity over the recession. So there's people today saying, ooh, I don't want to buy now because prices have doubled or tripled in certain areas. I want to wait till that happens again. But unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which side you're on, I don't think we're going to see any kind of major crash in the housing market because there's limited supply. And it's a very, very, very different situation than 10 years ago. 10 years ago, mortgages were ridiculous. Anyone could walk into a bank or talk to a mortgage broker and get a loan. It was, you could lie all day long. You just fill out a form and bam, you have a loan. It was not difficult. I was a mortgage broker. I know it well. And that's not the case today. Today, even if you are the best borrower, even if you have amazing credit in the 800s and lots of reserves in the bank, lots of cash in the bank, you're still going to have to go through a very rigorous process in applying for a loan. The people who have loans today and over the last 10 years have had to qualify. They've had to prove that they can make those payments. They're locked into low rates and they have lots of equity because prices have gone up. So nobody's going to, you know, even if you lost your job, you're not going to say, oh, I want to walk away from this house that has $100,000 equity and that's actually cheaper for me than going to rent. Most monthly mortgage payments are lower than renting that house today because rents have gone up so much. So you're just not going to see the same kind of scenario where people couldn't afford the payment that they were in and there was no equity. Of course, it's easy to walk away from that. It's not easy to walk away from a house that has a bunch of equity and a low payment.
Right. You know, it's interesting. There's some data from the Conference Board and it looks at the percent of Americans planning to buy a new home in the next 6 months. And that's actually moved higher. So it looks like Americans are planning on purchasing homes and it might be because of the lower mortgage rates as well, because it seems that there's a pretty close correlation between those two things. So if you look at the data, it does look like people are seeing that this is a good time to buy.
Yeah, you know, and it's not always about the interest rate. People were buying property in the 80s when interest rates were at 16, 17%. So it's not so much about the rate, it's about affordability. So right now, wages have gone up, people are working, unemployment is really low, and combined with housing prices, you know, not going up as quickly as they did over the last 10 years, they kind of stabilized this last year. People are in a position to be able to afford that property, and it's cheaper than renting in a lot of areas. I live in Southern California, and believe it or not, and it may be because of the fires we just had, and there's even more limited, even less inventory, should we say, rents, it's actually much more expensive to rent because lots of people don't have that down payment. So they're forced to rent and that's driving rents up. So if you can get that down payment, you can actually, it's easier to afford the home. But it's a very, very different scenario. Don't sit around waiting, thinking there's going to be another housing crisis. That's very unlikely simply due to the supply and demand situation. And like you and I talked about before the show, there's low inventory, low supply, high demand. And exacerbating that problem is that many of the homes that would normally be available for sale or for rent are Airbnb. They're little hotels now. And you just experienced
that. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, this is the first time that we have done this, but when we took our whole trip through California, going from Southern California to Northern California, touring the Redwoods and Tahoe, we stayed in Airbnbs the whole time. We didn't stay in any hotels because, I mean, it's just that much more convenient. You have the kitchen, you've got a whole house to spread out with. You know, we were sharing it with another people and it ends up being quite a bit cheaper than if you were to try to get multiple hotel rooms. So it really worked out. And I was thinking about it. I mean, all these people who own these Airbnbs, you know, they can rent out their house whenever they want. And it's just extremely convenient for them. And another thing I noticed too was when we were out on the road, there's so many people that are driving around in their RVs or in their Mercedes Sprinter vans. I mean, it looks like they live out of these things. Mm-hmm. I imagine a good portion of these people are probably renting out their houses through Airbnb to people like us. And then they're out on the road. They're enjoying their life, you know, touring the U.S.
That's so funny you say that. Yeah, there's 10,000 people turning 65 every day and they like to RV. You know, it's fun. You take your little house on the road and there's more and more luxuries that go with those RVs. But you also do have an increasing number of people saying, you know, the heck with it. I'm not paying these prices. I'm going to just live in my van. My five nephews live in their little Sprinter.
Oh, wow.
In the San Francisco Bay Area because they've got a startup, you know, and they don't have money and they need to be where the action's at. So yeah, they live in their little van and that's pretty common. It's definitely, things are changing. I just got back from Singularity University's Global Change Conference. These are the greatest minds in the world, the people who create the robotics and are creating the healthcare of the future. And I mean, my mind has been blown on what's coming. You're going to be able to live so much healthier, so much longer. They can 3D print your organs. If you need a new set of lungs, they can just take some samples of your lungs and print new ones. So there's so many new exciting things coming thanks to technology that we're going to see a very different world over the next 10 years. We can't even try to predict or base it on the last 10 years or the last 100 years or the last 1,000 years or whatever. It's going to be exponential growth. But one of the things that they really emphasized is that, thanks to, you can call them robots or just advanced machine learning or whatever, but you will not really have to go to the hospital because you can kind of get everything you need at your home. They deliver these. My sister's going through cancer treatment. She's coming through so well, and she's only spent a couple nights in the hospital. Most of the time, she's been able to be home with the traveling nurses and the medicines that they can bring to you. We're going to see more and more people aging in place. That's going to take more inventory off the market, basically, and maybe less demand for that senior housing and even for hospitals. So the changes coming are going to affect real estate. But what was so interesting is here I was in a room of people who were building flying taxis. They were building like robots that are basically stay-at-home nurses for you to watch over you all the time. unbelievable things coming in the future. But when I said, okay, well, what about housing? How's that going to get disrupted? And there was silence. They didn't know how to answer it yet. Now, something probably will change over the future. But as for now, at the end of the day, we still need a place to live. And sure, you can 3D print a home, but the regulations and the traffic and the need for water and all these things makes it still difficult to disrupt the housing world. So until we can figure out how to have they're working on it, having a society on Mars or build, it's just, land is still of great value. And that was really interesting to see with all these new technologies. They haven't really figured out how to make new land.
Yeah. Well, speaking of 3D printing, I have seen where they've been able to 3D print homes for quite cheap. They just 3D print it with concrete. And that seems like a pretty disruptive process if that was to be something that was used at a large scale. So, maybe that's something we're going to see that's going to lower the cost of housing for massive numbers of people. Who knows?
And they did say that. This was the exciting takeaway for Rich and me. They basically said that everything is going to be cheaper in the future. And that is not really something I've heard from very many economists. Most people are worried about inflation. But these guys were saying, no, we're going to have robots that can grow food much more easily. You can grow it on the side of a building or atop of a building. Food is going to be cheaper. They found out that there are lakes and lakes of water, clean water in the atmosphere that they now know how to suck down onto the earth. So the things that we will need in the future are more accessible, and it will lower the cost of things and cost of living. So the overall consensus was, wow, people aren't going to have to work as hard, as many hours in the future, because life will be more affordable. And so lots of really exciting, positive things. And I agree with you, there will be ways to build housing for cheaper, but there isn't a way yet to build more land. Not necessarily unless you just keep going vertical, but not everybody wants to live on the 30th floor, right? You want to walk outside and have some nature. So it was just very positive for me. I'm someone who invests in real estate. We help people buy little homes across the country that are like turnkey rentals, basically. They're fixed up and ready to go for rent. It was just very encouraging to see that that's something that's going to be in demand for a long time. Is no matter how much things change, people still prefer to live in a home.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that was one of the sticking points between my wife and I when we were looking to buy a home many years back was, how much of a yard were we going to have? And I would have been content to not have much of a yard. But, she really wanted to have that yard, a place to have the garden. And for some people, that is extremely important. We don't want to be holed up in a small little apartment, or like you said, you know, 50 floors up in a sky rise, for example. So, you know, unless people are content putting on virtual reality goggles and having a virtual garden or a virtual forest or something like that, I don't know. Maybe that could change that dynamic.
They did say that most. But in the future, 10 years from now, it will not be uncommon to live in a box that's all white. And with your, you know, VR goggles, you just, you know, you can have the ocean outside your window. But I don't know if that's going to do it for me. We'll see.
No, I don't think it'll work for everyone. No, it's just not quite the real thing. Now, I want to go to a point that you mentioned here, talking about how China's factoring in some of the things that we see with the trade war between US and China, and Chinese investors, their impact on the real estate market. Are you seeing much of an impact? And is this primarily concentrated on the high end of the market?
Yeah, it's not really going to affect the average American or the average home or the average apartment. What it is affecting is higher end homes and big commercial buildings. So basically, even before Trump and before the tariffs, the Chinese government was strongly encouraging its wealthy citizens to stop investing outside of China. I mean, you know, the U.S. was included in that, but really more than anything, it was, hey, it's time to invest in our own country. Bring your money back. We have these initiatives. We want you to invest in our initiatives here in China. Now, when you have a communist government telling you what to do, I think you're supposed to do it. So mm-hmm. And then, you know, add the tension between the US and China now from the tariffs. It's very difficult for a wealthy Chinese company or individual to get the sign off to invest in other countries and specifically in the US. So we are going to see some of the areas where there's been a lot of Chinese investment, there's going to be a pullback and people will feel that. We have a very large apartment that we are selling in right across from Google in Mountain View. And just a few years ago, there would have been a lot of bids on that from Chinese buyers because it's a very, very expensive property. It's going to be in the 200 million range. And those buyers aren't there. So, you know, who's going to be the next Chinese buyer? Now, in the 80s, when I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, it was the Japanese. They owned all the sky rises. They owned the big stuff. And then it became China that, you know, it became very prestigious to own world-class US property, but they're not really allowed to do it now. So, you know, who will be the next buyer? And that's what we're still trying to figure out.
Okay. Last time we talked about a project that you're working on in Costa Rica, I thought it was pretty interesting what you're developing there. Give us an update on where that stands and what you're doing.
Oh my gosh. Well, right now, so we were able to buy about 800 acres of really fertile, beautiful land in Costa Rica, about an hour inland. So it's higher elevation. It's not so hot, lots of rain. So it's just so fertile. So we planted 10,000 trees and we're building a residential community. And when I say it's rainy, I mean, you know, with the tropical weather, it'll rain for about an hour and then it goes away. So it's not like you're sitting in rain all the time. It's just,
it comes and goes.
It's just enough to water the plants and then be on its way. So we are building a community of people who want to have clean water, clean air, be able to go outside and into the garden and pick organic foods, to be able to go to the little local restaurant, the community restaurant, and have them, you know, have the New York City world class chef make you dinner and make the community dinner based on all this fresh, you know, fruit and vegetable that's grown locally. And it's crazy. I mean, we have an entire barn full of turmeric because, you know, like it grows so easy there. chickens and, you know, it's really spectacular. So it's just kind of an alternative way to live in a community where the homes are very nice. I mean, they range from 200,000 to, you know, million-dollar homes. There's a private runway on the land. It just came that way because the former owner had a private plane. So people can actually just fly onto the land in a little plane. It's not that expensive to take from the San Jose airport there to literally fly on the land. Right now, what we have going is the glamping part of it, which is As we're building the homes, we've kind of made a little resort out of really fancy tents. So glamping, they're like nice beds, hotel room beds, but it's in a tent and you have to walk outside to go to the bathroom in the public restroom. But there's the full yoga there and the five-star dining to give people the experience of what's coming in this residential resort retreat center. So we expect to have really cutting edge retreats. They're kind of like the one I just talked about from Singularity University with the world's greatest minds. So it's not a place to retreat in the sense of like pull out of the world. It's actually a place to kind of get away from it all for as a think tank for certain corporations or groups that don't want distractions and they want healthy living to be able to kind of focus on what's next.
And yeah, to live the Pura Vida lifestyle,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly. And what we're finding out now is this area is, I mean, we kind of had an idea before we bought the land, but this area is very up and coming. They're looking at bringing in the next international airport just 20 minutes away, which we're not sure we're happy about because we kind of loved that it was rural, but it's good for the value of our property. And a new freeway, a little road taking us directly to the beach. So instead of an hour to the beach, it'll be about 20 minutes. So that's the update. And anyone interested, you know, can just check it out at the glamping site where you can just go and glamp and have gourmet food and stay in a really nice tent for not very much. It's kinkara.com, K-I-N-K-A-R-A, kinkara.com is where you can go check that out. But if you're interested in either owning a home there or investing in the project, we've got some big, big names if you're going to be involved in this. You can check that out at our website.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It looks nice.
Yeah, it's incredible. People come back just feeling so revitalized, but just from the food and the air and the water alone, it's very pure. Pura Vida.
Yeah, exactly. Pura Vida. Some of the best coffee I had in my life was in Costa Rica. It might have been the atmosphere, but I think it probably, the purity of the water and just, you know, the richness of the soil probably was a good contributing factor.
Yes.
Well, Kathy, so it sounds like in all, if we think about your overall assessment for the housing market, you're not doom and gloom on the housing market. And on the converse, you believe that the housing market is fairly well supported by the same structural dynamics that we've been discussing with you for quite a while. The fact that we have extremely low inventory, there's not a lot of housing building taking place in order to keep up with demand. There still is fairly high demand because rental rates are pretty steep. So it's still affordable for many people to buy a home in parts of the country. It might not be true everywhere in some of the higher priced areas of the real estate market. And with the fact that mortgage rates now continue to head lower, again, at 3.5%, average 30-year fixed, and that could even head lower with negative interest rates in Europe and elsewhere. So a lot of these things are factoring together to keep the U.S. housing market afloat. You know, overall, would you say that you still think housing market is a good place to be and that it is a good time to buy?
You know, it just depends. I think the greatest need right now is for affordable housing. So what we're doing is going to looking at the parts of the country where there's job growth, where there's population growth and not enough housing. And we're either building new houses or helping investors buy little properties that they can easily rent out to the average person. The average person can afford it in that area. And it creates, I mean, people are still getting 8 to 12% returns as rental property owners, providing something that's desperately needed, which is housing. So yes, I'm still extremely bullish on affordable. I would be very cautious on any of the high end. If you own a rental property, say in California, that's $1 million and bringing in $3,000 or $4,000 a month, that's not a great investment. That's something I'd probably get out of very quickly while you can right now, because with lower interest rates, you'll have more potential for buyers and to be able to sell it. And then, and basically right now is an incredible time to reposition and get rid of overpriced assets that aren't really performing and get into kind of underpriced assets that are really high performing. And by that, I mean like Orlando, Tampa, Atlanta. Those are the areas that are the highest growing in the country. That is where the population is going over the next 10 years. The demographics are going to the Southeast, and yet you can still buy properties for $100,000 or, you know, $150,000 and rent them out for 1% of their cost and to people who can afford it and who need that housing. So there's great opportunity. Just like anything, you've got to pick the right asset. Like the stock, you could say the stock market's a bubble. Well, some stocks are and some are not. It's the same with housing. Some are in a bubble and some are not. You got to pick the right ones.
Yeah, very true. Well, Kathy, I want to thank you for coming on to our show today and giving us an update on the housing market and some interesting insights, of course, from your recent attendance of the Singularity University. Fascinating stuff that they do there. We've spoken with a number of people about some of the different work that they're conducting there. So it's always interesting to add that in. And we appreciate you coming on. We look forward to having you on our show in the future.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.